How do you locate a support group, professional association, or local organization? United Way's 211 will provide the answers to these questions and more. 211 is your connection to programs and services in Central Wisconsin. Dial 211 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In this ever-changing world, it is often hard to find the program or service you're looking for. United Way's 211 can assist you locating services. 211 is free and confidential. Trained referral specialists will help you get connected 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Dial 211. Every day, people begin a difficult and sometimes desperate search for programs that can provide assistance. United Way's 211 is there to connect you to the programs and services you need. For non-emergency information and referral services, call United Way's 211 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Dial 211. With thousands of programs in the database, they can assist you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Dial 211.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh.
Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
CBS News Brief. A jury has awarded $148 million in damages to two Georgia election workers who sued Rudy Giuliani for defamation. Shay Moss and her mother became the target of racist threats.
The lies Rudy Giuliani told about me and my mommy after the 2020 presidential election have changed our lives. And the past few years has been devastating.
Protesters in Tel Aviv are demanding the release of remaining hostages held by Hamas.
There's got to be a deal right now to bring them back, and that we have to do more things to help these people get out of this prison.
Arizona's governor has ordered National Guard troops to the southern border after the federal government closed a legal port of entry. Republican State Senator T.J. Shope spoke with KPHO-TV.
I don't know that there's anything here that we're doing that is going to move the needle in the direction of being able to open the port of entry.
CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
The Morning Show on WFHR. It's serious comedy.
Where you commit to walking 3 miles or doing 30 minutes on a bike every day in December.
You know, that's good. That's a decent goal. I have that goal. You know how many days I've reached it in the last month? One. Obviously, exercise produces endorphins, and endorphins make us happy, and happy people don't kill their husbands.
Weekdays from 8 to 10, right here on Locally Grown Radio.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248 DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Dreams of the Great Lakes generating offshore wind energy haven't worked out so far, but experts still think it can work. Here's Mike Mohn.
Despite early proposals that surfaced more than a decade ago, no commercial offshore wind turbines have been installed in the Great Lakes region. The University of Wisconsin's Greg Nemeth, who studies energy policy, says the Great Recession, lack of technology, and minimal interest from utilities thwarted the initial buzz. Some of those factors have changed, but Nemeth says there are still hurdles.
It seems to be because of increases in the cost of equipment, some of the specialized equipment that you need to work offshore, and then a higher interest rate environment.
In this month, the Lake Erie Energy Development Corporation decided to halt its Ohio wind project indefinitely. In the push for clean energy, it's hard to rule out an offshore project eventually being floated in places like Wisconsin. Nemeth says one attractive feature for offshore projects is you can build them closer to locations that have larger energy demands, with Milwaukee coming to mind. Land-based projects, despite their growth, still can face local opposition. Offshore projects do too, but Nemeth doesn't see them as being a big problem.
At the nearest, they'd be on the distant horizon, so you wouldn't really see them very much.
Even though aesthetics might not get local residents angered about an offshore project, he says impacts on birds and their migratory paths could drum up opposition to offshore development. However, some researchers say if technology matures for floating turbines in freshwater settings, it could help alleviate concerns about jumpstarting these kinds of projects in the Great Lakes region. This is Mike Mohn for Wisconsin News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Nicole Pollock for Inside Climate News.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Locally grown radio, your home for news, talk, and sports from Rudolph to Nakusa. 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. Your hometown news, talk, and sports station is locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, rain showers and a high near 40 degrees. For tonight, showers come to an end. We'll have cloudy skies and a low of 33. Cloudy for Sunday, temperatures near 40 and a little breezy again. For Monday, mostly sunny, a high of 25, 35 Tuesday.
It's 39 at our studios.
Did you know Wisconsin Rapids used to be two towns, one on each side of the river? Centralia consolidated with Grand Rapids, but residents wanted a name change. Too much mail ended up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not Wisconsin. Wisconsin Rapids became the official city name in 1920. For locally grown radio, WFHR, I'm Terry Barr.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to our broadcast on this wonderful Saturday morning. It is another day in the month of December coming to you from the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. We're broadcasting this morning, as always, from the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha, but coming to you throughout the state of Wisconsin. Thank you for joining me this morning for our Saturday morning broadcast on this 16th day of December 2023. This is our 76th broadcast since coming on the air in June of 2022, and delighted, as always, to have you with us this morning for our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion, our assessment of the most important news stories, events, and happenings, what in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always, I am supported this morning in our Civic Media studios by my extraordinary producer, Anya. We are here, as I said, in Waukesha, but we are taking your phone calls, your questions, your inquiries in particular, through two basic mechanisms. One is call us. Call us at that number, 844-967-2789. That number, once again, 844-967-2789. Or you can also go onto the Civic Media website, the Civic Media app, if you've got that as well. Find your particular broadcast station. Find our show this morning and send Anya and me a note, specifically a question, a comment, an inquiry you have about things on our syllabus this morning. As always, inviting you to be part of our engaging, hopefully informative discussion as well. We ask, in connection with that discussion with you, stations throughout the state of Wisconsin, three fundamental questions, and that is going to guide our discussion, our analysis this morning as well. First, we ask, what happened? What are the basic news stories of this past week that animate our lives and our livelihoods? What do we know? What can we say for certain about the truth that is out there? A basic predicate to any good discussion of civics, constitutional issues, law, and government in America. Second, why are those issues important? Why do we care? Why are they relevant? Why are they material? Why are they significant in our lives? Why should they be the focus of our attention, not just this morning on this Saturday morning broadcast, but throughout our days? Because they animate our lives once again. And third, in many instances, what should we do? Not telling you how to react, telling you how to respond directly, but if there are things that in your own decisional process, in your own discretion, you decide you need to act upon, what are those mechanisms, those methods by which you can, in fact, respond to the important things that are going on in America, in justice, in law, and in government? All those three questions, very much a part of our ambitious, but yes, was always achievable agenda this morning. Hopefully for you, for all of us, informative, and maybe even inspiring along the way. Delighted once again to have you with me and with Anya today, talking about all of these very important things. What are those very important things? This morning, we're going to begin, especially in our first hour, with a rule of law agenda focusing upon the general concept of accountability. Accountability, calling to account those folks who engaged in conduct that is contrary to the mores and norms and even the laws, both civil and criminal, of our nation and of our state. How are we animated today by this notion of accountability, much related to other topics we have talked about here on our Saturday morning broadcast, those involving issues having to do with deterrence, both specific deterrence as to individuals who've engaged in those kinds of actions, and also general deterrence, the messages being sent broadly to all of us about the kinds of things that can happen, both civilly and criminally, for those folks who decide to violate our basic standards of conduct in our state and in our nation. Accountability this morning on the agenda for our Saturday morning broadcast. Accounting for conduct. And we're specifically going to talk about some major news stories, some of which have been breaking just in the past couple of days. Yes, at the top of our agenda this morning is going to be discussion about this major decision by a federal grand jury with respect to the defamation case against former U.S. attorney, former mayor, former advisor to the president named Rudy Giuliani, coming out of a federal court, a major victory. A victory for not only poll workers, but the specific poll workers coming out of Georgia, defamed by Rudy Giuliani. We're going to talk about the damages, the harm they suffered, the fact that they are victimized by his conduct, but also their transcendent comments after the return of a jury verdict, the things that make them heroes today, accounting, calling to account people like Rudy Giuliani, the messages that come out of that prosecution, that civil prosecution, the things we can all take from it. The deterrence, both specific as to Mr. Giuliani, but also general deterrence for others who might think about compromising the conduct not only of our poll workers, but of those people who are engaged in the elective process throughout our nation. Then we're also going to talk about accountability in two other areas from cases of about 10 days ago. Two other significant defendants who just this past month were also sentenced for their involvement in the January 6th riot, the insurrection at the Capitol building. We're going to talk about someone who's fairly notorious in terms of his conduct on that day and someone who's famous for his past Olympic involvement, the differences in their responses, the accountability as to both of them, but the differences, the deterrence as to both of them and the different ways in which they have responded to the conduct in which they engaged, messages coming from that, lessons coming from that as well. And then we're going to talk about some apologies. Lots of things written these days in the early part of the 21st century, the later part of the 20th century as well, about apologies. How do you make apologies in America? Why is that this morning a rule of law, a government, a justice issue as well? Because it turns out that two of the defendants, you know them, their names well, they're Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell, coming out of the Georgia prosecution, the attempt in that state under state law, in violation of state law in the state of Georgia, to undermine, to affect, to compromise the votes in that election in 2020. Their pleas of a number of weeks ago, just this past week, we sampled the apologies that they wrote. I'm going to talk about what they said in their handwritten skeletal apologies. I'm going to compare them to the apologies written by two other defendants who also pled guilty to the charges against them coming out of Georgia. The comparisons between those, this sense once again about sending messages, about acknowledging behavior, the importance of that not only for moving on individually as defendants, but also sending once again messages to our entire nation, certainly the people of Georgia, who are at least the immediate focus of those apologies, about the conduct that is violative of the state law, the state criminal law in those cases. We're going to talk about that as well. A lot of accountability issues this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast. And then as always, as we promised last broadcast, continuing today, a lot of focus upon the Supreme Court, including two major cases that the Supreme Court decided just in the past couple of days to take on, granting certiorari to basically review lower court decisions, one of those having to do with January 6th, the prosecution of defendants like the two we're going to talk about this morning, and also the prosecution of the former president. That case also pending in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. We're going to talk about a major case now brought before the United States Supreme Court that may have a dramatic impact upon those different sets but related sets of prosecutions going on in our federal courts in Washington, D.C. And then we're also going to talk about a second case coming out of Texas, in particular the Fifth Circuit, having to do with this abortion pill, mifepristone. We have talked about that a lot in the past. The United States Supreme Court just this past week decided to grant certiorari to review the decision of a lower court, the Fifth Circuit, that basically kept mifepristone legal when it comes to one of the two drugs that can be administered properly, legally, in connection with delivering abortion reproductive rights services to women, but also imposing some great access restrictions on it. The Supreme Court, just this past week, deciding to review that case, reviewing that important Privacy Act case and the impact that it has not only in terms of access to abortion in America, a decision that the Supreme Court had said they're not going to revisit, forced once again to revisit it just because of the content, the nature of that decision in Dobbs. It's back again, members of our Supreme Court, and they're going to review again the implications of Dobbs with related to this particular pill coming out of this Fifth Circuit case having to do with the restrictions on access to it. And then we're going to move into, that's a perfect segue into our larger issue, which began at the end of last broadcast, focusing upon the future of America. The promises made by one candidate, his name once again is Donald Trump, reviewing the promises, the commitments he has made to a future of America, if in fact he is elected our next president, the things that he has said, his campaign has said, both orally and in writing, about the commitments he is going to make in rule of law, in government, in justice areas. We began last week by talking about this Project 2025, which is the larger umbrella of policies and practices that he has already announced, distanced by some of his campaign workers, but nonetheless a part of the public record that he has announced. We talked last week about this thing called the unitary executive theory, this notion that animates a lot of Project 2025, the notion that we're going to consolidate, if indeed there is a second Trump presidency, a huge amount of authority and responsibility inside the White House, inside the Oval Office, inside the presidency, in a way that it has never been done before, not in the 240 years of our republic. That unitary executive theory animating a lot of that, animating also this doubt about agencies, which we also talked about last week, these three cases, now four with this recent mifepristone case, in which the Supreme Court is addressing, too, the lack of confidence in, the lack of support for the legitimate, experience-based decisions made by our agencies. We're going to talk again about some of those Supreme Court cases and the way that they fit into this overall notion of being suspicious about government, being suspicious about the executives who are out there. When we come back, we're going to launch into that agenda. Stay with us for that syllabus here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
From Wisconsin Rapids to Stevens Point, your news, talk, and sports is 97.5 FM, locally grown radio.
Hey, Dad, how do airplanes fly? What's in this box? Can I touch this? Where does sand come from? Is this tree good for climbing? What happens if I mix these two things together? How are babies made? What does this thing do?
Kids are curious about everything, including guns.
Talking to them about gun safety in your home is a good first step, but you can do more. Always keep your guns locked, unloaded, and stored separately from ammunition. Storing your guns securely is the best way to prevent family fire, including unintentional shootings. For more information on safe gun storage and ways to keep your family safe, visit endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org.
What do we keep in the attic? What's this thing called? Can I ride my bike backwards?
Like I said, kids are curious. It's up to us to keep them safe. Brought to you by End Family Fire, Brady, and the Ad Council.
From the hometown of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news talk and sports station.
We are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me and Anya here in our Waukesha studios, but broadcasting throughout stations throughout our wonderful state of Wisconsin and even beyond, also streaming, of course, online as well. We're going to begin again in our discussion this morning of concepts of accountability and, yes, also deterrence, both specific and general, by talking about this major decision rendered just yesterday by a jury against Rudy Giuliani, a former United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, the chief federal law enforcement officer many, many years ago in the Reagan administration, goes on to be the mayor of the city of New York, and also then goes on to be a senior advisor for President Trump. And that in many ways is where his decline begins. A former public servant yesterday ordered to pay $148 million to the election workers that he defamed, a finding in a civil court about his liability for that misconduct, again in connection with the 2020 lies that he and others told in connection with the so-called theft, the attempt to undermine the election, which in fact never happened, the conduct that he alleged by these poll workers attempting to steal the election in which they did not engage. A jury on Friday ordered Rudolph W. Giuliani to pay this huge amount to two former Georgia election workers who said that he had destroyed their reputation with the lies, indeed the lies that he told in his attempt to try to compromise the results of the 2020 election and put Donald Trump in office, return him to the White House in a way that would be contrary to not only the results in Georgia, but also throughout the United States of America. A judge, Beryl Howell, used to be the chief judge of the district court in Washington, D.C. She presided over many of the cases involving now approximately 1,200 of the rioters on January 6th. Judge Beryl Howell, presiding over this week-long trial, had already ruled prior to the review by the jury that Giuliani had, in fact, defamed these two workers. Their names, you know them well, Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. The jury, because the judge had already made that determination, that substantive factual determination that they had been defamed, had been asked only to decide the amount of damages. No small thing at all, but nonetheless, that was the focus. Indeed, Rudy Giuliani, in advance of the start of this week's trial, had basically not cooperated with discovery, prompting the judge to make that finding against him on the substantive counts of defamation. And the jury then returned a whopping verdict by any amount of assessment. And how do you understand the components of that jury verdict? $75 million in punitive damages. What are punitive damages? Civil cases, punitive damages, the word punitive coming from punishment, same sort of root. And basically it means just that, we are punishing you. It's a message from the jury to the particular defendant, in this case, Rudy Giuliani, a message to the entire world that if you engage in this kind of behavior, we're going to not only condemn it, but we're going to punish you over and beyond a second category of damages, which we'll talk about. We're going to condemn you, we're going to punish you for that simply because of the heinous, outrageous nature of your behavior. $75 million in punitive damages, we are punishing Rudy Giuliani for his behavior. And then there is this second category of damages, also a part of the overall verdict returned by the jury yesterday. Compensatory damages of $16.2 million to Ms. Freeman and $16.9 million to Ms. Moss, and an additional $20 million to each of them for their emotional suffering. And what is that all about? Well, the emotional suffering, obviously, the things that they described in great detail during the course of their compelling and heart-wrenching testimony during the course of the trial in this case, all of that supporting this finding by the jury, a factual finding that they have suffered. They have been victims of the conduct of Rudy Giuliani. And what do they describe? They describe, among other things, the ways in which their lives have been dramatically changed forever by the things that he said about them that were simply not true, indicating that based upon a videotape, he reported that they were passing a USB port between themselves and that that was election fraud. And as a result of that, they have been harassed. They've been forced to leave their home. They have been in many ways under the radar, both publicly and privately. They testified about it. They can't even identify themselves in public, uncertain about where their next steps may be because of the harassment, the threats of violence visited upon them, all as a result of the misstatements, the lies perpetrated, the defamation perpetrated by Rudy Giuliani in this case. And as a result of that, Ms. Freeman, in the wake of all of this, again, the compensatory damages, compensating them for the specific harms, the damages that they suffered, and then sending also this message to Rudy Giuliani and others who might engage in the same kind of thing, who might think about engaging in similar conduct, this huge amount of punitive damages, a total of $148 million. Along the way, lots of questions, of course, about whether Rudy Giuliani will ever be able to pay that amount. Well, one of the things that he did not do during the course of discovery was disclose his own financial status. An awful lot of reason to believe that he is in dire financial straits. It is unclear whether he will ever be able to pay that amount of money, but it's also been very clear from the attorneys and, yes, by the two plaintiffs in this case, that they're going to pursue that amount. There are all kinds of things that can be done civilly to try to recover that amount. In the wake of that, Ms. Moss said, "Today's a good day." She told reporters after the jury deliberation, the return of this verdict, that no amount of money that she and her co-plaintiff in this case could possibly have gotten could give her and her daughter back what they lost in the abuse that they suffered. Those are her words after the trial verdict in this case, falsely being accused of manipulating in Georgia the vote count. Giuliani himself, who helped, of course, as you know well, in perpetuating this complete lie about the Trump so-called victory in 2020, said, "I don't regret a damn thing," he said. He said that the torrent of attacks and the threats the women received from the Trump supporters in the wake of his conduct were abominable and deplorable, but that he was not responsible for them. Not any accountability there at all. Also indicating, of course, that he is going to appeal that as he can to the higher court, the appeals court, in all of this. The attorney for Rudy Giuliani indicating that the amount of money returned by the jury, more actually than the lawyers for the plaintiffs wanted, the amount of money returned in that jury verdict, they described it as absurd. The defamation claims, of course, are a part of other defamation claims that have also been successful in our courts. You recall well the Dominion Voting Systems case. Dominion Voting Systems wrestles $787.5 million out of Fox News. When did that happen? Early this year, they sued that media giant for promoting lies, also that its voting machines were used in some kind of a conspiracy to flip votes away from Donald Trump and in favor of Joseph Biden. In October, another kind of case similar to this one, a judge in Atlanta also ruled that a Georgia man had engaged in defamation. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about that particular case, the ways in which they are significant, and the takeaways about accountability coming out of this case just this past week. Stay with us for that discussion.
Something don't feel right because it ain't right, especially coming up after midnight. I smell your secrets and I'm not too perfect.
Whether you're hanging out on stage.
Stop surfing the dial. You found the greatest station ever. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. We're learning more about that tragic friendly fire incident in Gaza that killed three Israeli hostages.
The Israeli soldiers who shot and killed three Israeli hostages in Gaza by mistake did not follow the army's rules of engagement. The three young men were apparently holding a long stick with a white fabric attached to it, but the soldier who spotted them felt threatened and opened fire, killing two of the hostages. The soldier believed they were Hamas terrorists laying a trap. The third hostage escaped but was killed shortly after in a nearby building, despite yelling for help in Hebrew. Hamas terrorists are known to be fighting in civilian clothes, making it difficult for the IDF to identify them. Yotam Confino for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
A jury has awarded major damages to two former Georgia election workers who sued Rudy Giuliani for defamation over lies he spread about them in the 2020 election. CBS's Scott McFarlane has the story.
The plaintiff's attorneys asked the jury to do just that, to award punitive damages in a way that would send a message to anybody ahead of 2024 about the danger and damage of false claims and conspiracy theories. And not only did the jury seem to hear that message, the punitive damages were more than half of the total judgment. It was $75 million out of $148 million.
A major storm system is making its way to Florida. Here's Kelly Cass at the Weather Channel.
We're talking about a lot of rain and even the potential for severe weather in the Sunshine State. Not good news. A lot of people travel to Florida this time of year for the holidays. You've got people heading down here for the winter season. And yes, there is a chance that we could see tornadoes out of the system that's moving on through.
An independent review has looked into how police handled concerns about a mass shooter in Maine months before his shooting rampage. Here's CBS's Stacey Lynn.
Despite receiving warnings about the man's deteriorating mental health, drunken threats, and possession of guns, the sheriff's office avoided confronting Robert Card, the 40-year-old Army reservist who later killed 18 people at a bowling alley and bar. The third-party report found the department did respond reasonably to concerns about his mental health prior to the attack, but it did reveal there were missed opportunities to intervene to prevent the tragedy.
The Boston Tea Party happened 250 years ago today. University of New Hampshire professor Elijah Gould says Britain badly miscalculated by passing harsh laws in response.
And if you look at this from the British standpoint, overreacting to something is usually not a good idea. If Parliament handled this more carefully, they might not have lost the colonies.
Mayim Bialik is out as the host of Jeopardy on social media. She did not say why. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger, because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Wendy's Peppermint Frosty and Frosty Cream Cold Brew make the perfect gift for anyone in your life. Especially for you. Yeah, this year you're sitting on your own lap and getting yourself what you want. Finally. And if you need a little more pep in your step, get yourself a refreshing Peppermint Frosty Cream Cold Brew. Or you can give it to your mom. Whatever.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's. Vanilla Frosty is temporarily unavailable.
Locally grown radio, WFHR programming, is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
From the home of the Cranberry Blossom Festival, your news talk and sports station is Locally Grown Radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season.
News talk and sports on both sides of the dial from Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Us. If I were a boy, even
And just for
And we are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for once again joining me for our discussion right now about this major decision coming out of a federal district court. Just yesterday, a jury awarding a huge amount of money, $148 million in favor of the two plaintiffs in this case, Rudy Freeman and Shay Moss, against the defendant, Rudy Giuliani, for the defamation. Right before the break, talking about some other defamation cases, including this case in October in a judge in Atlanta, finding that a Georgia man allowed to continue his defamation claims against a filmmaker named Dinesh D'Souza on claims that he had been wrongly accused of voter fraud in a book in a film called 2000 Mules. All of these defamation cases, why are they significant? Defamation is a tough thing to show in court, and it's happening more and more based upon the outrageous nature of comments made, including the kinds of things that Rudy Giuliani made about the two plaintiffs in this particular case. Among other things, we know that in the wake of his misstatements, his lies, his fraud about things that they did not do as poll workers there in Georgia, as a result of that, they were flooded with expletive-laden phone calls and messages, threats, racist attacks, all of that a part of their testimony just this past week. People said they should have been hanged for their treason, that they should be lynched. Others told them that they fantasized about hearing the sound of their necks snapping. That is damages of the highest order. Victimization by virtue of the words of Rudy Giuliani in that defamation case. And all of this as a result of that defamation resulting in this significant verdict. In the end, again, a message not only to Rudy Giuliani, but also to anybody else out there who might think of engaging in these kinds of false statements about poll workers. And sort of the large takeaways, again, an affirmation of the important work that poll workers do every single election. We've got several of them coming up right here in the state of Wisconsin, throughout the nation, as you well know, in 2024. Critically important roles to play, poll workers in our system. When this kind of thing goes unaddressed, when there's no accountability for it, those poll workers are also potentially threatened, potentially victimized, not in this case, in the end, without accountability. Rudy Giuliani, the message sent to him is that your defamation results in this huge judgment. Jim called in, sent in a message asking about the mechanisms by which this particular verdict could be executed, which is the way that we speak as lawyers about making sure that there is payment made. All kinds of things can happen here. Again, some reporting, obviously, that he's going to take this up in appeal. And yes, indeed, the execution of that judgment may be stayed until that appellate proceeding is completely resolved. But there are all kinds of things. Liens on property, liens on bank accounts, all sorts of financial information, which now can also be the subject of what are called collateral-related proceedings to get after the money. All kinds of opportunities to seize properties, both financial properties, other things that he has within his entire ambit, if you will, of financial resources. All those things can be pursued. Typically, there is some decision made prior to, or sometimes even after the verdict is returned, about the split between plaintiffs and their attorneys. That was Jim's principal question along the way. Here, highly likely that the two plaintiffs, again, the successful plaintiffs in this case, the two plaintiffs here, Ruby Freeman, Shay Moss, going to get a significant amount of whatever can be recovered. Some attorney's fees also going to the attorneys in this matter. Probably a matter for decision between those two groups, that is the plaintiffs themselves and the attorneys, probably the source of some pretrial and pre-litigation agreement between them. But again, the important thing here is a judgment entered and almost certainly to be executed against Mr. Giuliani. Depending upon how much money is out there, all those things can be the subject of pursuit in the federal court. Along the way, during the course of this action, and especially at the end of this trial, we know that Ms. Moss and Ms. Moss and Ms. Freeman both commented to the media about the things that had happened to them. She said it was they said it was devastating. She said no election worker should ever have to face what we have faced. She said, you all matter. You all matter, and you are all important. Also said, I miss my home. I miss my neighbors. I miss my name. Our greatest wish, they said, our greatest wish is that no election worker or voter or school board member or anyone else ever experiences anything like what we went through. That's Shea Moss talking in the wake of this very significant verdict on behalf of her and Ruby Freeman coming out of the federal district court. Deterrence, both specific and general, and accountability, accountability in the courts of our land. Let's talk about those same issues when it comes to two other matters, not from just this past week, but from the week before this past week. As you know, as we reported on and commented upon a lot on this Saturday morning broadcast, approximately 1,200 people already the subject of criminal investigations and trials and convictions and sentences related to the assault, the attack on our Capitol on January 6th of 2020. Among them, many people, again, being sentenced by the Beryl Howells of the world, former chief judge of the district court, other judges out there in the District of Columbia, likewise imposing sentences upon the defendants following their convictions, most of them pleading guilty, most of them pleading guilty. But in this, these two particular cases we're going to talk about this morning, one of them having pled guilty and taken responsibility, accountability for the things that he did. The other one going to trial, representing himself, interestingly, not taking responsibility even to the moments of his sentencing again in the past couple of weeks. Let's first of all talk about the lessons coming out of these two cases. First of all, former U.S. Olympic swimmer, Cleet Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R, sentenced about 14 days or so ago to 36 months of probation for his role, his specific role in the riot at the U.S. Capitol. He avoids prison time after pleading guilty to a federal felony. Keller, who's 41, also sentenced to do 6 months of home detention and have to perform 10 hours of community service every month. The two-time gold medalist was one of the first January 6th riot defendants to plead guilty. He pled guilty early on to all of this, and we'll talk about the reasons why it's just now coming to a sentencing. Was seen in videos, again, which form the basis for a lot of these prosecutions, wearing a Team USA jacket, the Olympic jacket, in the Capitol Rotunda, and was surrounded by other members of the mob at that time. Now, what happens in the wake of that? Well, Keller was indicted on 7 federal counts in the weeks following that attack, but a deal that he reached at that time with prosecutors had him pleading guilty to only a single count of obstructing an official proceeding. Obstructing an official proceeding, that was his plea agreement at the time, and that carries, interestingly, a maximum sentence of 20 years in jail. Federal prosecutors actually, in the course of the sentencing, sought 10 months of imprisonment in the sentencing of just recent times. And they argued that Keller's actions on that day, January 6th, were, in their words, unconscionable. Yes, they were. And that they will forever be a stain on this country's narrative. Words that plainly can apply to virtually everybody who is involved in this. However, and this is the point, and this is the point about accountability, but also sense of deterrence and responsibility. The reason for the result, the sentencing result in this case, is because he was also given extensive consideration for his equally extensive cooperation with the government since turning himself in, and it was called his genuine remorse by the prosecutors, by the judge who's presiding over this case, for his conduct. They even pushed the judge to give him a far lighter prison sentence than he otherwise would have been given. The defense countered that in response to the government's request that there be a 10-month a period of imprisonment, the defense countered that he had already been suffering as a result of this. And sure enough, during the course of the sentencing before the judge there in the district court, Judge Gillian, the judge told this former Olympian that he, the judge, wanted him to speak to young adults about how he learned from his mistakes. And he later told Keller, I expect you to succeed. That's the judge talking to the defendant, Keller, during the course of this sentencing. In the wake of his cooperation with the government, his acknowledgement of responsibility, his accountability in all of this, Keller responds in this way. He says this. He says, "Thank you, Your Honor. I will not let you down." He told the court that he understood that his actions, these are his words, were criminal, and I take responsibility. He apologized to lawmakers and the American people. Went on to say this, "I condemn the violence of that day." He vowed not to repeat the actions of the past. Those his specific words. He went on to apologize not only orally, but in a lengthy, keep that in mind, lengthy letter that he wrote to Judge Leon. It was dated January 23rd, 2023, in which he described this as a way to better understand who I am beyond my bad choices on that terrible day, and all of that as a part of his sentencing. He said, "At the time of the sentencing, I stand before you, Judge, feeling ashamed and profoundly embarrassed. On January 6, 2021, I unlawfully entered the United States Capitol building and demonstrated without permission. I am ashamed to admit that I wanted to interrupt and influence Congress's certification of the Electoral College vote. As a former member of the United States Olympic swimming team, my behavior set a terrible example for young people who looked up to me. I take full responsibility for my inexcusable actions. I will accept my punishment with humility and serve my sentence in peace." That's the defendant Keller just about 10, 14 days or so ago in these letters written to the judge as a part of the disposition of his case. All of that about accountability in the federal district court by a defendant, again, who's sending this message, these messages not only to America, but also plainly to others who are out there who might think once again about trying to undermine our democracy. Take the lesson from defendant Keller and the things that he is plainly going to do at the encouragement of Judge Leon to go out there and engage with youth and presumably other people in our nation to send that same message, not only of deterrence, but accountability for things you do and prevention in the first place. Don't do this. That's his message. And look at me. Look what happened to me as a result of the incredibly bad decisions that I made. I now understand them. Don't follow in my footsteps. Contrary to that disposition is another one that also speaks to us about accountability and deterrence in just the opposite direction. In this case, a retired California police chief who led the protests and called for traitors in government, in these words of his, to be executed as an example, was sentenced recently to 135 months. That's just over 11 years in federal prison for his role in the January 6th riot. Now, what is this case all about? This case involves Alan Hostetter, H-O-S-T-E-T-T-E-R, a part, again, of this violent attack upon our Capitol on January 6th of 2021. He represented himself during the course of the trial. He has a right to go to trial. That is guaranteed in the Constitution. That's a part of our statutory authority as well. Alan Hostetter was convicted of conspiring to obstruct Congress's certification of the Biden electoral victory. He brought a hatchet into the Capitol grounds and also engaged in disorderly conduct. And while he joined the mob on the steps of the Capitol, he interestingly stopped short of entering the building, even though he had that hatchet in his hands, and did not specifically assault any police officers during the riot, which we have seen among other defendants. Nonetheless, the government, during the course of his recent sentencing, described the defendant's conduct as terrorism. Through his words and deeds, the assistant U.S. attorney said, "Alan Hostetter was a terrorist." And here's the point. During the course of his allocution, during his sentencing, unlike Keller, which we just spoke about, his sentencing, Hostetter does just the opposite. He denies wrongdoing and gives a lengthy conspiratorial rant. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about that Hostetter result and the reasons why it, too, stands as a lesson in American jurisprudence in recent times, a lesson about deterrence and accountability in our courts. Stay with me for that discussion.
You're listening to Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
Jimmy K here for the UPS store. Every Gillette Intimate gives guys a gentle and easy shave on there. And around there. And even under there. Don't treat your groin like junk. Respect it with Gillette Intimate, the best a man can get. Buy now at a retailer near you.
Temperatures getting low, but demand remains high? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. And Indeed's interview tool lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews right from their website. Visit Indeed.com/credits.
Dive into the festive spirit with Quality Foods Holiday Seafood Sale, where ocean and holiday delights meet. Elevate your holiday feast with the finest seafood. Succulent shrimp starting at $8.49 a pound. Lobster tails starting at $6.99 each. And don't forget the decadent king crab legs. Quality Foods Seafood Sale has it all. Don't miss out on these treasures from the ocean. Then celebrate with a bounty from the sea. Drop by the Quality Foods locations of Wisconsin Rapids to reel in the savings. More details at qualityfoodswisrapids.com.
Your place for this area's news, talk, and sports. We are Locally Grown Radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
For continuing to join me this Saturday morning, discussing all sorts of things related to deterrence in America and accountability by people brought into our federal and even our state courts along the way. Discussing right now this case involving this retired police chief whose name is Alan Hostetter, sentenced to just over 11 years by a federal district court for his involvement in January 6th. Significantly, during the course of his sentencing, showing very little, if any, remorse, just the opposite of the sort of remorse that Keller evidenced during the course of his almost contemporaneous sentencing in federal court. Hostetter denied any wrongdoing for his behavior. Gives a lengthy conspiratorial rant claiming that the Capitol riot was a result of one of these false flag attacks, which again is a rallying point for some folks in this country now who maintain that all of this was set up. He goes on to say that the entire attack was engineered by the federal government. He says, "I have full faith and confidence that the truth will come out. And when it does, it will shock people." He said that during the course of his sentencing hearing for his own behavior. He was also praised significantly. This is the reason why these things do not fall on deaf ears. The reason why these kinds of comments and the statements that these folks make are so dangerous in America. He was praised. He praised Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy for saying it Wednesday at the previous primary debate on Wednesday of that week, about how this now looks like it was an inside job, this perpetuation of these crazy, absolutely meltdown conspiratorial theories about January 6th and other things as well. This particular defendant also endorses a whole series of baseless fringe theories about the, for example, the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. Remember her? Again, another victim of the events of January 6th, but this was a woman who was killed by a police officer while she was attempting to breach a locked door in the Capitol. We saw those visual, horrific images. Hostetter remains that that was all stage. He says she wasn't actually killed that day. And that claim in the federal court, that public claim, hugely angered Ashley Babbitt's surviving mother. Her name is Mickey Whitehoff, who attended the hearing on that day. Whitehoff confronted Hostetter outside the courtroom, calling him arrogant and telling him, "You need help." The government itself had asked, actually, that Judge Royce Lambert, who was the judge imposing the sentence here, impose a sentence of just over 12 years. The judge came pretty close in doing just about that. And significantly, a footnote to all of this, which is that during the course of the trial, some, not all of the evidence, comes from one of the co-defendants, in this case, a California man named Russell Taylor. And Taylor comes forth during the course of the trial and said he helped plan the protest with Hostetter, joined Hostetter in Washington, D.C., and while armed with a knife and body armor and a stun baton, the two of them, again, making these plans to assault the Capitol. Taylor himself pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with the government as a part of this overall prosecution. Hostetter continued to dispute Taylor's testimony, even at his sentencing hearing. And wrapping up his remarks, he thanked Judge Lambert, amazingly, for allowing him to speak at length about the case. "You always have given me the opportunity," Hostetter says, "to flap my gums." That's the thing the defendant says during the course of the sentencing hearing of just this past week. no sense of responsibility, no sense of individual responsibility for the kind of conduct in which he was engaged. And in that connection, a couple of more comments also coming out just from recent history. We know that in the Georgia prosecution, we already have four of the 19 defendants that Georgia prosecution premised upon state charges of individuals, defendants across the board, having engaged in criminal conduct to undermine the election there in Georgia, again, the 2020 election, all sorts of RICO violations alleged in that indictment. Four of them already pleading guilty. Among them, as we also already know, a fellow named Ken Chesbro, much related to the state of Wisconsin, and Sidney Powell. As a part of their pleas to criminal offense conduct, they not only, as a part of their arrangement with the state, remain free, but they also agreed to write letters of apology. And just this past week, as a result of some good work by the media in these cases, we got evidence of what those trial statements were, what those specific letters of apology, both handwritten in their own hands and stunningly not indicating, boy, by their content, the force, anything related to the kind of thing that Cleet Keller described when he was sentenced, just the opposite. We've got the statement by Sidney Powell saying this: "I apologize for my actions in connection with the events in Coffee County." And that's it. That's all that she says in her letter of apology. Ken Chesbro says, "I apologize to the citizens of the state of Georgia and Fulton County for my involvement in count 15 of the indictment." Now, we know, based upon things presented in the course of the presentations of those pleas, we know what that was all about. But that is not the kind of contrition. That's not the kind of acknowledgement. That's not the kind of deterrence that we would hope would be coming from these people who are now admittedly cooperating. We have seen in the public domain some leaked tapes of some of their cooperative testimony, and it indicates that they may in fact be giving some additional information. But they stand, these particular handwritten, singular, multiple word sentences that the two authored as a result of their plea agreements, not the kind of thing that you would believe would come out of a true sense of remorse and messages to our overall population about the things that will happen if indeed you engage in this kind of conduct. We know, of course, that those other defendants in Georgia are continuing to move forward. Fannie Willis, who is the prosecutor in that case, along with all of her staff, also appearing in front of judges, in this recent proceedings in that forum, to talk about the future of that case, perhaps maybe going to trial sometime in the summer of next year, more likely sometime later in the year, maybe going into 2025, as Fannie Willis herself has indicated. The judge also indicating highly unlikely that particular case will be resolved today, again, we have in our public understanding information about what these two defendants said and did not say in the context of their public apologies, all about deterrence in America. In our second hour, we're going to come back and talk more about those issues, rule of law issues, and then turn not only to the Supreme Court, but to other things related to the future of America, promises, commitments made by one of our presidential candidates. Stay with us for the second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast.
There's nothing better than the vilest.
Locally grown radio, WFHR programming, is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
DoorWorks, I have a serious problem, and I don't know if I need you or an exorcist. My garage door opens all on its own without me pushing the button or anything.
Ma'am, let me do a little investigating, and I'll have an answer for you in no time.
I discovered the problem, but it took a little detective work. Your equipment is absolutely fine.
Is it possessed, then?
No, ma'am. It's much simpler than that. Sometimes a low battery can trigger the door to open randomly. We've cast out your dead battery, and your door is working fine.
WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
CBS News Brief. Israel is mourning the death of three Israeli hostages mistakenly killed by Israeli soldiers in Gaza City. The BBC's Frank Gardner describes what happened.
They had